Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
It is 5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Good afternoon. Glad you're with us. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for being here for another edition of On DOD. It was 2 years ago this month that the Pentagon put out some new guidance designed to shake up the way its acquisition professionals go about their business of buying products and services. Better buying power was branded by the then Pentagon acquisitions chief, Ashton Carter, as a way to get better value for defense dollars without targeting industry profits. Our guest for most of the hour today is Frank Kendall. He was principal deputy undersecretary of defense at the time Better Buying Power was signed 2 years ago. He's since moved up to the position of undersecretary, gaining Senate confirmation in May. We talked in his Pentagon office earlier this week about what elements of Better Buying Power have served their purpose and which ones haven't. Secretary Kendall, thanks so much for coming on Federal News Radio. Appreciate you doing this.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So really everything I want to talk to you about today is really around one big question, which is 2 years after Better Buying Power started, what has worked and what has not? Let's start with the good news, I guess. What in your view out of these, gosh, there was more than two dozen individual directives, I think, in the implementing guidance, out of that whole acquisition improvement soup, what can you look back on and say, this has really worked well?
Well, first of all, the whole idea of Better Buying Power is to implement a philosophy of continuous improvement. That the particular list of items, I think there were 23, that we put out 2 years ago, were a number of attempts to get better results out of the acquisition system. And there were policies or ideas that we thought had a lot of merit, but the idea was to put them into effect, to monitor how well they worked and make adjustments as necessary, and also to look for other ideas. We've been at it for about 2 years now. I think we've had some successes. We've had a few things that we didn't get the implementation quite right on, and we've had a few things that we probably could drop as not being very effective. We're about to roll out another version of Better Buying Power called Better Buying Power 2.0, which will basically be the next round of continuous improvement, if you will. As the things that worked well, I would have to say that one of the things that I particularly was interested in was the affordability caps that we put on programs. In the past, what the department tends to have done is to get a requirement from the warfighter and then set out to build systems that met that requirement almost without regard to cost. You know, not just the cost of the instant product, but the affordability of that product within our budget overall and out for the life cycle of the product. So what we started doing at the time of Better Buying Power 2 years ago was imposing cost caps on our programs for affordability reasons. And we did that not by analyzing the cost of the product that people want to buy, but by looking at the amount of money that would be available to buy any product. We'd look out over the life cycle of the product. We'd analyze portfolios, for example, ground combat vehicles from the Army, and determine what we thought was reasonably going to be available in future budgets for that portfolio. How many vehicles we'd want to have in the inventory, how long they'd last, and then calculating a unit cost that was an affordable unit cost. And once we have that, then we can force the design to fit into that basket. So I think implementing affordability targets, both for production and support, sustainment, was one of the things I think we've gotten pretty far into the process of and fairly successful. Another one was should cost, the idea of should cost, which it took us, I think, we struggled a bit with this, in the sense of trying to communicate to the workforce what we really had in mind, because it's a slightly different idea of should cost than has been used in the past. But the basic philosophy here was that we should not just accept the cost projections. Usually we fund in our budget to the independent cost estimate that's developed for a program, and then we tend to execute to try to stay within that. We're not terribly successful at that, but that's been the way we've operated in the past. The idea of should cost was that we should not accept the independent cost estimate as a self-fulfilling prophecy and assume we would spend to that level, that we should really understand our cost structures, look at them very, very carefully, and assess opportunities to reduce costs, and then attack those costs and try to achieve that should cost level. So the idea was that we would be very proactively managing costs, thinking about it well ahead of time, looking for opportunities to reduce costs. And I think this idea has gotten across to the workforce now. It took a long time, but I think we've had a lot of success with that.
To put a slightly finer point on that, the reason, as I understand it, that you don't want to manage to those will cost estimates is because they're based on costs and schedules that were inflated in the past, and you're just causing yourself to extrapolate that out into future programs, correct?
Yeah, that's basically correct. We basically analyze the history of products in a given area, and we look at the growth trends in those costs, and we project forward based on those. You know, you look at the complexity of the product and a number of other factors. But, you know, inevitably, if you put more money into a program, you're less likely to overrun. But that's not really the direction we want to go in. We want to go in a direction of trying to drive costs down.
When you look back at some of the acquisitions over these past 2 years that you've made, or programs that have been ongoing over the past couple of years, are there some that you can call out as saying, we got a better value for this directly because of some of these principles and better buying power?
Yeah, I think the attention we've paid to cost, and whether it's affordability or should cost, or just the whole idea of actively and aggressively managing cost, has helped in a number of areas. I could point to some of the multi-year buys that we've done. Lately, the MH-60 helicopter did very well there. The Navy did a very good job on the Littoral Combat Ships of getting a win-win business solution that will get us more products for a lower amount of money. Took advantage of the competitive situation that we created there and maximized the return on that. We've set affordability caps on programs like the Ohio replacement submarine, and the Navy has been aggressively designing to try to drive its cost down to get within that cap. We did something similar on the ground combat vehicle program. This was one of the first ones for the Army, where they have basically gone out to industry and asked for designs that are consistent with their affordability cap, and they have competitors now who are trying to achieve that for them. So there are a number of successes, I think. Going forward, on the affordability side, our task is going to be to actually enforce our caps and force the requirements in the operational communities in particular to accept the fact that they have to trade away some requirements they would like to have. That's going to be difficult for them. So I think we've made good progress there, but our most difficult work remains to be done.
All those successes you just mentioned were products, and we'll talk more about service contracting as we go on, but does should-cost, will-cost management also apply in a big way to services?
Absolutely. I mean, service contracting has cost elements just as products do. It's described a little bit differently. And the services contracting area is a very broad area. It encompasses everything from facilities support services to maintenance to research and development services, knowledge-based services, they're called. So it's a wide range of different types of business activities, if you will. And each of them has their own cost structure that's associated with that type of work. And so in each case, there are best practices. So one of the things that we've done on the services side was start, first of all, to pay attention. We needed to again, proactively manage service contracting. And a lot of service contracting is done by people who are outside the normal product development side of acquisition. It includes people like installation commanders. In the case of combat operations, it includes a lot of contract support that's overseas, supporting our overseas contingency operations. So we have to, in each case, go in and using a kind of a should-cost philosophy or management approach, understand all the cost elements associated with that type of service contracting, and then see where we can find opportunities to reduce costs.
And I think one of the things that you would say is a success in that area is having put senior officials, I believe, at the Deputy Assistant Secretary level for services in each of the military branches. Has that borne fruit yet?
Yes, it has. We actually, the Air Force set the example in this regard. The Air Force had a program executive officer, General Wendy Masiello, who was their program executive officer, was the title the Air Force used for services contracting. And she instituted a number of the practices that we included in the first iteration of Better Buying Power. Part of that was to put somebody in charge, and the other services have done so. I regard it more as a senior manager for service contracting. Our counterpart to that exists in our defense procurement and acquisition policy organization here in OSD.
So give me a big picture on that, if you would. Compare where we were 2 years ago with, as far as our expertise, and I think that the phraseology that DOD used was tradecraft in service contracting compared to where we are today.
We've made progress, but we still have a long way to go. We've gotten somebody in place in each service, as we discussed, to take the leadership role. We developed a taxonomy of services. I talked about part of that earlier, the different types of service contracting mm-hmm. that we do, because the trade craft, as you mentioned, is associated with each of those different types of service contracting. And now we're going to go down a level to put people in charge of each of those areas on each service and make sure that they're gathering the data they need, talking to each other, and developing best practices across the department for each of those areas.
And that taxonomy problem you mentioned, right, was the fact that each of the services tended to call different categories of services different things. So up at your level, you couldn't really track what was what and what was going on where.
We were not tracking it as carefully as we should have been. The Federal Procurement Data System has a set of categories that we adopted, which works reasonably well. We report on all our contracts using that system, so it's a good source of data to help us understand how we're doing. There are some problems with it that we need to address, but it gives us a start, at least, at getting our arms around how we're doing.
Can you give me some hints on what those problems to be addressed are?
Yeah, one of them is that contracts, every individual contract transaction that's reported in that database is associated with one of the types of services that I talked about, even though it may include a number of different types of services within the same contract. So what we're going to try to do is go to contract line items that are separated by the categories that I mentioned, so we can collect data that's more relevant to each of those different categories.
Frank Kendall is the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics, our guest this week on DoD. We'll take a short break here, and when we return, we'll start to talk about some of the elements of better buying power that he believes haven't quite served their purpose, maybe need some updating. This is on DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening to On DoD. Our guest this week, Frank Kendall, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. We're spending most of the hour talking about better buying power. It turned 2 years old just this month. Spent the last segment talking about some of the things he thinks were successful in that initiative so far. But as he said, a new 2.0 version is about to come out, he says, in about a month. In this segment, we're going to talk about some of the elements in the original Better Buying Power documents that he thinks need some updating. Let's switch to some of the things that maybe you feel like need some tweaking here. of any of those elements that haven't worked as DoD originally envisioned, what's the reasons behind that? Were they bad ideas to start with, poorly communicated to folks? What happened?
I think there are a couple that we probably just need to do more work on. One of them that we did not really get off the ground as well as we had hoped to was the idea of a preferred supplier program. Mm. This is the idea that we recognize and somehow reward our best performing suppliers.
A Navy idea, right?
It was originally a Navy idea, and we tried to implement it on a DoD-wide scale, and I think we ran into some problems because of that. Could never come to agreement on how to do it. And I think we took too narrow an approach as to what we would consider and how we would recognize or reward better performance. So we basically handed it back to the Navy to kind of take a leadership role on, similar in a way to the services contracting leadership role the Air Force took originally. So we're going to still move that forward. I think it's still an important thing to do, but we've had to retrench a little bit on that one.
But as of today, it has not. It's basically where we were when we
it's
started.
It's still a work in progress. I'd say we're further along than we were 2 years ago, but we still have a ways to go.
Okay, that's one. And anything else that you think needs to have a reboot or get eliminated from the program altogether?
One that we're adjusting, I guess I'll use that word, is the guidance we put out on fixed-price incentive fee contracting. We held that up as a type of contract that we thought should be used more often. And both Dr. Carter and I were concerned at the time there might be an overreaction of that, and it turns out that our concern had some validity. A lot of people leaped onto that as the, I'll call it the school solution, and started doing fixed price and 7 fee contracting because they thought that was the approved type of contract. We always wanted people to think carefully about the right type of contract to use in any given situation. And we have a range of contract types for very good reasons. We did think that fixed price incentive could be used more than it was being used, and we tried to push people in that direction a little bit. The place where it really comes into play, I think, most appropriately and where it wasn't being used enough is in the early lots of production of products, where you can estimate the cost of the product with some degree of certainty, but not quite as much as you would like to have for a firm fixed price contracting, but with enough that a cost-plus vehicle isn't the right vehicle either. So that's the place where we think we should do more of that. We wanted to narrow that going forward. But we also wanted to make sure people understood that there are a lot of different types of contracts because we have a lot of different types of situations. And they need to understand which type of contract is most appropriate for which situation and then use that. So we're going to back off a little bit from that and try to moderate our guidance a little bit on that one.
As I saw it, the initial guidance was already somewhat moderated because it said fixed price incentive fee is the point of departure. And from there, you know, use your brain and think and figure out which is the most appropriate. Is that still the right way to think about it, or you have a new way of saying this?
It's the point of departure probably for LRIP. In general, fixed price is the point of departure for most of our contracting. But we caveat out with when it's appropriate. We use words like that. But basically, I think it's just an education effort for us to make sure the workforce understands the full range of contract vehicles that are available and when they should be used. And again, this is a reaction to what we saw from the workforce after we put better buying power out the first time.
To the extent that that education piece has been an issue with implementation of better buying power, can you talk a little bit about why that has been? Would you do anything differently with that education piece if you had this to do it over again? Is this a function of a relatively new, relatively green workforce as you try to rebuild it from the cuts that happened in the 90s?
I think it's a function as much as anything of the vast enterprise that is Department of Defense. Mm. You know, we 150,000-odd people employed in acquisition across the department, hundreds of thousands contracts let each year. The workload on our people is pretty high. And if they know there's a certain way that, you know, preferred for them to do things, there's going to be a tendency to default to that unless there's guidance otherwise. One of the biggest problems with any management initiative like Better Buying Power is communicating it effectively. And we did it a lot right after Better Buying Power rolled out to communicate to our management structure, put things into our courses at Defense Acquisition University and other places, and to communicate to the workforce. But I think you can always do better at that. We made a number of visits. Dr. Carter and I made a number of visits to the major buying commands. We enlisted the service acquisition and component acquisition executives in doing the same sort of thing. But I think that our experience reflects that you can't do too much of that. And I think as we go into this next iteration, we'll be working even harder at that.
I want to go back real quickly to the fixed price incentive fee issue. I'm sure you hear the same criticism we do all the time from industry, which is that it's being used inappropriately in situations that are inappropriate for fixed price contracts. Are you saying that did happen and that's a valid criticism, or is industry just never going to like an increase in fixed price contracts?
Well, I think there were cases certainly where that did happen. And I saw I see a relatively small number of the contracts that we do coming in for review here mm-hmm. for the major acquisition programs primarily as they go through their milestone reviews. And I did see a movement towards fixed price that I thought was inappropriate in at least two or three cases for some of the major programs, usually for development. I mean, I have a long history in this business, and there was a period in the late 80s when fixed price development was considered to be a solution to a lot of our problems. It didn't work out that way. Fixed price development turned out to be a big problem for us because it was not realistic for or appropriate for a lot of the development contracts we're letting. And once you get into that kind of a contractual arrangement, it's very hard to get out of it without quite a mess. So we went away from it entirely for a while. And 20 years later or so, kind of came back in vogue again. I'm cautious about fixed price development. Most of the time when we're doing development, there is some degree of risk. That's why it's called development. And there isn't, I'd like to say we could be perfect in our estimates of how long things will take and what they'll cost, but the fact of the matter is there are a lot of forces for optimism in our system. And I think we're prudent if we recognize that those are there and try to manage with that in mind rather than try to dictate them away.
Our guest this week on DOD is Frank Kendall, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. We're talking better buying power this hour. We'll continue our conversation after another short break, starting with the value of competition and gaining better value for defense dollars. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbia. Our guest for most of this hour is Frank Kendall, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. We're discussing the department's Better Buying Power initiative, 2 years old as of this month, and it's due for an update. That's coming out in about a month, according to Mr. Kendall. We talked about the initiative, what's happened so far, and what's next in his Pentagon office earlier this week. I've heard you say many times that the best thing you can do to drive costs down is competition, competition, competition. That being so important, is there any reason to be concerned as the DoD budget comes down over the next several years that industry is going to consolidate and you're just going to flat out have less competition?
Well, a couple of concerns there. I think as opportunities diminish, as there are fewer things for people to bid on, to chase, they're going to be more optimistic and more aggressive in their bidding. And we'll have to watch for that. I haven't seen too many cases of that so far, but I'm afraid as opportunities diminish, people are going to be chasing that work and taking more risk on the industry side, being more optimistic, if you will, about what they can do. And we may get into some situations. That's another reason not to be doing fixed price development. As far as consolidation is concerned, Dr. Carter gave a speech a couple of years ago at a conference in New York, and what he outlined at that time is still the way the department feels about this. At the top tier, there was a lot of consolidation at the end of the Cold War. I was for part of that time in government and part of that time in industry, and I was in the middle of all that. We think at the top tier, we're probably much about where we need to be, and we would probably not look very favorably on additional consolidation at that level. Below that, market forces should come into play, and we expect that firms will be looking for ways to position themselves. That's a healthy activity as firms try to strengthen themselves because of the change in the market conditions. And we'll be watching it and making judgments on a case-by-case basis. We will be trying to preserve competition where we think that the business will allow for competition. And we'll maybe trying to protect certain areas where we have key capabilities that we want to make sure are preserved. But market forces will tend to dominate that, I think.
To stick with industry, one of the things you did, I want to say a few months after the guidance came out, was to go out to industry and say, hey, listen, if there are things that we are requiring of you that are increasing your costs and therefore our costs, but aren't adding any value to the process, we want to hear about it. Please tell us what those are. Have you gotten anything valuable from that process so far?
One thing that's come back is the audits, okay, that tend to stretch things out a lot. It's not a direct cost driver, but because it delays payments and it makes it harder to negotiate contracts, it makes the whole process more inefficient. So we're working closely with the DCIA, which reports to the Undersecretary for Financial Management, to try to reduce the backlog, fundamentally, of audits. And there are a number of things that Pat Fitzgerald, who's the director of DCIA, is working on to try to make that happen. That's the only thing off the top of my list that is an overhead burden, if you will, that industry has come back to us with that's really gotten a lot of attention.
This guidance came out in late 2010, and a lot's happened since then, including a major strategic budget review. You've got a 13-17 budget that looks quite a bit different than probably what you were expecting back then. Has that fact changed the way you think about addressing costs through these initiatives, or has it just made them more important?
It's only made them more important. The imperative to control our cost is stronger than ever. We took almost $500 billion out of the department over 10 years. And when we saw that coming, we knew we had to do that. We went through about a two-month strategic planning process, which resulted in the paper that we published, I think, last January, that laid out a strategy for the department for national security and kind of laid out the resources that we would have and the things we would be able to do. Then we went through the budget process and built the budget around that strategy. There are a lot of challenges in there. We're trying to do as much as we possibly can with the resources. There's continuing pressure on the budget. I don't expect it to lessen. I'm hopeful that sequestration will not occur and that we won't be forced to take another $50 billion a year out. But I don't know where the numbers are going to end up at after the budget dust settles sometime probably after the first of the year. So the challenge that we have going forward is going to be to get as much value as we possibly can for the warfighter and for the taxpayer. And the reason, in part, that we're doing another iteration of better buying power is because we recognize those challenges and that we have to continue to try to address them every way that we can. And I'm a firm believer in continuous improvement. I'm a firm believer that we need to pay attention to cost. We need to focus on them continuously. It needs to be very much in the forefront of our thought processes and the way we manage, and that people across the acquisition system and anybody who's contracting out in the department trying to get as much value as possible for the taxpayers' dollars needs to be working on that and trying to get more for the money.
You brought up sequestration. One of the, I think, more stark things that's come out of the analysis recently is it would have an immediate and really severe impact on the civilian workforce. You guys couldn't wait to start doing possibly RIFs, but in any case, a reduction in costs there. Given all the work you've done to try to build up this acquisition workforce, how big a deal would that be on that particular area of the DoD budget?
Sequestration is pretty devastating to the department. Leadership from Secretary Panetta through Dr. Carter, myself, and others have been very straightforward about the impacts of sequestration. It's going to have a devastating impact. A lot of the efficiencies we've tried to achieve over the last couple of years are going to be held at risk. It is not just the number. In fact, it's not primarily the number or the size of the reduction. It's the way we're going to have to take it. And it's the lack of flexibility we expect to have in how we implement it. We're going to be in a damage limitation mode in FY13, at least, if we are forced to absorb the cuts that come from sequestration. Now, that said, the way it would be implemented is it's about a 9.4% is the recent number from OMB, cut across the board to all of our different accounts. So we'd be looking at things like furloughs for civilian employees. We'd be looking at cuts in some of our production rates. Some places we'd be forced to break contracts and renegotiate them. We'd be looking at cuts that affected our ability to prosecute the war, cuts in the OCO funding. In some extent, we could make up for those things from funding in the base that were in the same account. But then that would, of course, set the base back even more. So that's not exactly a win-win. That's a lose-lose. I do not see necessarily immediate layoffs. Okay, we would be a quarter into the year at the time sequestration hit, so we would have expended some of the funds, but we would have to make adjustments that would play out over the remainder of the year, and we would have to figure out on a case-by-case basis how we would do that. You know, there is some chance that we'll have a little more flexibility than we initially thought. It's possible that we may be able to take the cuts by account as opposed to by budget line, if you will. And in which case, we'll have to make some decisions about that. That's still uncertain, as far as I can tell. I don't think people should be panicking about sequestration. First of all, I think that the Congress understands that it's a devastating thing that should not be allowed to happen. It was never intended to happen. It was intended as a tool to force the Congress to address the deficit problem and get cuts some more rational way. So I'm hopeful, and I've not talked to anyone on the Hill who thinks it's a good idea.
Sure.
So I'm hopeful that once we get the election behind us, saner minds will prevail, and we'll be able to avoid it.
In the few minutes we have left, I want to stick with workforce if we can. And as I mentioned, that's been a priority, even if building up the rest of the civilian workforce hasn't. The acquisition workforce has. How would you assess the department's progress over the past couple years, and what more do you need to do?
There's been a focus the last 2 years on, or the 3 years really, I think, on adding to the size of the acquisition workforce. The workforce was cut pretty dramatically in the 90s. And so there's a rebuilding from the point of view of quantity. I don't expect much more of that, if any. In fact, we may have to come down a little bit given budget realities. But I'm turning my attention very much to the capability and capacity of the workforce. And it is partly the need to train younger people that have come in. We brought a lot of entry-level people in. Mm-hmm. And we have a bathtub in the workforce in general where people are approaching retirement on one end and new people on the other side. And what we need to do is capture that experience and that knowledge that's in the force that's going to be retiring, that element of the force, and transition that into the new entrants and the people in the middle. So there's a lot that needs to be done there. I think I will be emphasizing the professionalism of the workforce and the importance of having a professional workforce. You know, we do rocket science. This is hard stuff.
Sure.
Acquisition is complicated. You have to understand the business side of it, the technical side of it. You have to understand the customer's needs. You have to understand how incentives work with industry. You have to be able to balance a number of factors to bring a program in or to execute a contract or to deliver a service or a product. And that takes real professionalism. And I think the services, in particular as institutions, need to recognize that and embrace it and help us develop the level of capability of the workforce. So that's going to be a focus going forward.
As far as developing that capability and capacity, does that happen mostly through formalized, institutionalized training at DAU-type places, or do you bring in old hands as annuitants to train some of the newer guys? How does that happen in your view?
It's a combination of all of those. It's a mix of your formal education. It's a mix of your professional education that you get through institutions like Defense Acquisition University. But it's largely what you learn through doing. It's largely what you do learn through experience working with people who are more experienced, or you get opportunities to take responsibility and learn from that. It's working on smaller projects so that you work your way up to working on larger ones. And it's work, and it includes hopefully some training with industry or some experience from the other side of the table so you understand how industry views things. It also probably includes for many people some time with operators so that you understand how the operational community works and what actually is important to them and how their needs can best be met. So it's a wide range of things. I think by the time someone gets to take on a key leadership position for a major program, for example, they should have had decades of experience getting ready for that job. It's a lot of responsibility. It's very similar to taking a major command. And whether you're talking about a program manager or a chief engineer or a chief contracting officer or a logistics support, lifecycle support person, all those key leadership positions need to have all the different range of experiences, education, and training that are necessary to prepare for one of those positions.
Secretary Kendall, it's been a really interesting interview. Thanks so much for spending so much time with us, and good luck with Better Buying Power 2.0.
Thank you, Jared. It's been my pleasure.
Frank Kendall is the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics. We will post that interview along with the rest of this show at federalnewsradio.com later on. We'll take one more break, and when we come back, we're going to shift our focus to another of the areas that we're examining in a week-long special series here on Federal News Radio. We're calling it the Obama Impact, examining some of the major government-wide initiatives that have taken place over the last several years. Acquisition is one of those focus areas. Another is the workforce across the federal government. We'll turn our attention specifically to the cyber workforce as we hear from two guests from the Defense Information Systems Agency. We'll talk about their role in a new effort to establish joint cyber training across the military services. This is on DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia. Welcome back to on DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia. For our last segment this week, we're going to turn our focus to another one of the government-wide initiatives that we've been focusing on all week at Federal News Radio during our special multimedia series, The Obama Impact, evaluating the last 4 years. That is workforce in particular. We're talking about the cyber workforce in this segment with the Defense Information Systems Agency. Our guests for this segment are Henry Sinkowitz, the Vice Chief Information Assurance Executive at DISA, and Roger Greenwell, DISA's Director for Field Security Operations. That agency has just embarked on a new effort to develop joint cyber training for the entire military. Sinkowitz says it actually builds on efforts that DISA's had underway for years.
I think DISA clearly believes that our mission is to help provide a global learning and assessment environment to support that mission-ready DoD cybersecurity workforce. I liken it very much to we've got cars out on the roads, and we have to teach people how to drive. We have to teach people how to be the mechanics. We have to have the police officers out there. And there are pieces and parts of all of those roles for everyone inside the department. And DISA clearly believes that we're here to help augment the services and the agencies and their training aspects. Our vision is very clear. We believe that we're going to help establish a very robust cybersecurity workforce development and certification program that will help prepare DoD cyber warriors to operate and defend our networks in that increasingly threat-based environment. And we're going to be training them to one standard. General Alexander, a few months ago, made a very clear statement, and we inside the agency wholeheartedly agree with him. And to quote him, that whether we do our cyber training at one school or at multiple schools, the training will have to be executed to one standard. And we clearly believe that there needs to be one standard that is set by the department for the department. As we move and transition the Department of Defense into the joint enterprise environment, that whole environment needs to be able to be supported by consistent, repeatable behaviors. There are going to be service-specific attributes. We clearly know that the services are doing a great job on training their cyber workforce. We just believe that that DISA, as well as our other mission partners like NDU, have very good roles in helping augment those training and setting some of those standards.
So can you talk a little bit about how, to the extent this needs deconflicting, how you deconflict what NDU is doing versus what DISA is doing versus what the individual military services are doing?
Well, actually, I don't see any significant points of deconfliction. There is just so much that we all know has to be done, and the question is who is going to do what. We've been actively engaged with NDU, our NDU mission partners, and lots of compliments to Dr. Childs there for stepping out and creating a very robust cyber training program there that we are going to be looking at for some of the guidance.
Is there any way to characterize what the DISA training piece is versus what the military services are going to be doing?
I think for us, some of those basic tenets inside our cyber training program are very straightforward. We're working on a strategy roadmap that we have been sharing across the department. We've briefed it very, very publicly in some of the information assurance symposiums that have been created. We've been partnering with the SciTech, the cryptological community, to make sure that we're in synchronization with them, and obviously listening to the DASD and the DoD CIO on what they're trying to do. But our focus is very much on the individual and crew certification, vice the individual weapon systems, weaponization of cyber training that the services have a clear role on, and the other higher level things, operational, strategic vantage point that's very clearly inside of CyberComm's chain.
We're talking with the Defense Information Systems Agency about their new joint cyber training program they're building. And also with us is Roger Greenwell. He's the director of DISA's field security operations. And Mr. Greenwell, Mr. Sienkiewicz mentioned that DISA's had a role in, you know, a security training for a long time at the information assurance realm. Compare that with what you're doing now as you expand that out into the broader realm of cyber training.
So FSO has been delivering IE-related training to basically the DoD workforce for many years now in terms of a lot of general information assurance awareness courses, and what we're doing is expand that to the full cyber realm. So what we're doing is leveraging a lot of the constructs of the NICE framework, the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education, in identifying basically a role-based construct. So as we look at the various roles that an individual would play, we're making the determination of what's the appropriate training, what is the knowledge, what is the skills, what is the abilities of each person playing one of those specific roles, and working towards the development of more modularized training. That training can then be leveraged across each specific role, or in some cases, a certain training module may be more appropriate to different roles. At this point, we're focused on the CND analyst. So this is basically the net defender who is doing a lot of the monitoring of the DoD networks, identifying what the actual products and capabilities are for that net defender, what are his or her responsibilities, identifying all of the actual tools in use, and then developing the actual training products that fit each of those particular roles in a more modular fashion.
You mentioned CND. Is that really the only focus right now? Does that expand? How many do you envision happening?
There are approximately 42 roles that need to be overall defined. Right now, our initial focus is around the CND analyst, the Computer Network Defense Analyst. We're also looking at the systems administrator, the network administrator, and also, if you will, the IA auditor, or a person who is actually coming in and assessing a readiness perspective on organization. So those are the four areas that we're starting our initial focus on. Needless to say, this is an extensive effort to look at, again, all of the tools that are used from an enterprise perspective and map them out across each of these different roles.
This is going to sound like kind of a dumb question, but cyber is kind of a nebulous term. You talked before about expanding from the IA realm up into the cyber realm. Can you define for me what that is exactly as you see it, how you define cyber in that space versus IA?
It's a great question, and I think all of us are going through that transition in our minds on what is cyber versus as a warfighting domain versus what IA has. And I think when we look at what cyber is for us, cyber is a more holistic view. At times, IA has focused on compliancy and governance and making sure we've put patches in and we've done the right types of state compliance. cyber is a little bit more holistic. When we look at it, we've got to understand the entire context of the networks and the systems and the applications and the mobility devices and how all of this interacts and how do we make sure that it's secure and the rest of the information is attributable and authenticated inside the DoD.
We've been talking with Henry Sinkowitz. He is the Vice Chief Information Assurance Executive at the Defense Information Systems Agency, and also Roger Greenwell. This is Director of Field Security Operations. Gentlemen, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Jared.
That's it for this week's edition of On DoD. If you missed our earlier interview in this hour with Frank Kendall, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics, that will be on our website later on, along with the rest of this week's show. Thanks for joining us for another edition of On DoD. I'm Jared Servin. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.